We are now going to begin the, well, I shouldn't say begin, we're going to continue with the third installment of the ongoing archive series, which I may very well install as Radio Free America 36 when it is completed. It's called The Destabilization of the USSR in Eastern Europe, A Prelude to World War III? Question mark. And I'm going to read an article here which falls in line with what I discussed last week. One of the points that I touched on last week was that, and as we touched on in the discussion just concluded with Lanny Sinkin, one of the points that I made last week was that the success of the Patriot missiles in the Middle East War, in the Gulf War, has been used by George Bush to push for Star Wars and a slightly scaled-back version of Star Wars. And in the Sean Gervasi article that we looked at last week from Covert Action Information Bulletin number 35, that article is entitled Full Court Press, The Destabilization of the Soviet Union. Gervasi made the point, and he, by the way, is an economist, last name G-E-R-V-A-S-I. Gervasi made the point that in his opinion, and I think he makes an excellent case, the huge military buildup under the Reagan administration and the very alarming rhetoric about fighting and winning a nuclear war and perhaps even Reagan's little quip about we start bombing in 5 minutes, that this basically was intended to frighten the Soviets into trying to match our military buildup, thus straining the Soviet economy to the breaking point. One of the things mentioned in some studies done by the Rand Corporation, which appear to have been directly attendant on this policy that was pursued by Reagan, involved the Strategic Defense Initiative, or Star Wars, a missile defense system which would be used to protect the United States, an anti-missile system used to protect the United States against a theoretical Soviet first strike. An article in the San Francisco Chronicle that appeared on Thursday, March 14th of 1991, sheds further light on what we're seeing with the new push for Star Wars, and as I theorized last week, the new push for Star Wars, in my opinion, may very well represent a continuation of that policy, a challenge to the Soviets to match our military buildup, thereby straining their economy and further entangling the already considerable social unrest in the Soviet Union, which might even become the ex-Soviet Union if the United States gets its way. Reading again from the San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, March 14th of 1991, this is an article by Donna Cassata, C-A-S-S-A-T-A, of the Associated Press at Stateline, Washington, and headline, GOP urges treaty change to permit Star Wars testing, and it reads in part as follows. A leading Senate Republican, in an attempt to bolster the Star Wars program, yesterday challenged the U.S.-Soviet treaty restricting testing of anti-ballistic missile systems. With the backing of the Bush administration, Senator John Warner of Virginia introduced a measure urging the president to negotiate with the Soviet Union on, quote, reasonable adjustments, unquote, to the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty. Well, if in fact those adjustments are made, or if we decide to chuck the 1972 ABM treaty, that would open the way for Star Wars testing, and that obviously would, if the Soviets decide to match it, and their military strategic thinkers probably will attempt to do something. It certainly will increase the pressure on the Soviets to avoid military cutbacks, thereby, as I said, increasing the military spending and thereby further burdening their economy and destabilizing their society. If this treaty is thrown out, it will obviously permit the United States to go ahead with Star Wars much more easily. And again, I mentioned that in addition to many other things, the Gulf War appears to me to be, in essence, a flanking maneuver aimed at the Soviets, and also a good example of the Nazi technique of Schrecklichkeit, or frightfulness. Not only are the United States now on, is the United States now on the Soviet southern flank in a big way, they have had devastating military success against some largely dated, but some contemporary Soviet air defense systems. And this apparently has caused some serious alarm, at least vis-a-vis their air defense systems and possible reductions in military spending in the Soviet military elite. I read last week into the record an article in the London Observer of October 21st of 1990 that indicates that the United States may very well have baited Saddam Hussein into invading Iraq. There are a number of indications that may be the case. Now, most significantly, a study commissioned for the Arab oil-producing nations, and Iraq in particular, by the very conservative and Reagan and Bush-allied Washington Center for Strategic and International Studies that encouraged an Arab nation with the ability to do so, quote-unquote, to put military pressure on, diplomatic pressure on its neighbors to raise the price of crude. Also, a number of diplomatic signals were sent to Saddam Hussein, including, most notably, a conversation that U.S. Ambassador to Iraq April Glaspie had with Saddam Hussein, indicating that Arab border disputes were of no interest to the United States. To what extent the refurbishing of the Star Wars program, which itself I see as, among other things, in addition to providing new buckaroos for the defense industries, is an element of what I see as a continuation of the full court press destabilization policy against the USSR that I outlined last week. In that Sean Gervaisi article, another element in the destabilization of the USSR, the full court press that was discussed, was the use of proxy war. And I have discussed in the first installment how the Gulf War represented at least a perception of the superiority of U.S. arms over Soviet arms, and at least to a certain extent, it has caused serious alarm in Soviet military circles about the possible reduction of military spending, which they feel might place them at a future disadvantage vis-a-vis the United States. Bearing in mind, again, the phrase proxy war, which was in the Sean Gervaisi article that I read into the record last week, this headline, and I'm only going to read the headline from the Los Angeles Times of Wednesday, February 20th of 1991. This is an article by Robert C. Toth, or Toth, T-O-T-H, of the L.A. Times, Dateline, Washington. Headline, proxy war, U.S. facing Soviet tactics and weapons, and subheaded, combatants, analysts see a laboratory for hypothetical East-West conflict. It may be that articles like this are intended to shape the Soviet thinking along the lines of the way we want them to think, namely seeing the Gulf War as a potential triumph or as an actual triumph of American military technology over Soviet military technology in order to spur them to avoid reductions in military spending with the effects that I have already outlined. Obviously, we cannot say that for sure, but as I like to say, food for thought and grounds for further research. Something else arising out of the Gulf War, and whether this was planned, such as perhaps the Star Wars the new Star Wars push was, and again, I can't say that for sure, but I suspect that may be the case, FFT, GFFR, and something else which has grown out of the Gulf War, and which certainly has to alarm Soviet strategic and military planners, is the fact that the Germans, who obviously have a history of aggression against the Soviet Union, and of whom the Germans, or the Soviets rather, are rightfully afraid, the Germans are now discussing a wider military role for their armed forces. Reading now from the Los Angeles Times of Thursday, March 14th of 1991, this same article was excerpted both in the Chronicle and the San Jose Mercury News of that same day. This is an article by Tyler Marshall of the LA Times, Dateline Berlin, and headlined, Kohl discusses a wider role for German military. It reads in part as follows. In a major speech, Chancellor Helmut Kohl on Wednesday moved closer to formally endorsing a wider role for the German military forces. Kohl told the opening session of a two-day conference on the future of Germany in Europe that the country should reject a limited constitutional change allowing its armed forces or Bundeswehr to participate only in token UN peacekeeping forces and instead consider broader options, skipping down. While such a wider role for German military forces has been discussed informally as part of a debate about a possible constitutional amendment, Kohl's remarks were the first in such a formal setting and seemed to set the government's position. A proposal to amend the Constitution is expected later this year. Quote, the idea that German forces should operate outside Europe or within larger, integrated European units has not been put forward like this before, unquote, said Eckhart Ehrenberg, E-C-K-E-H-A-R-D-T, E-H-R-E-N-B-E-R-G, Director of the Research Institute for Security Policy and International Development in Bonn. Again quoting, it's new, unquote. Kohl's comments and the debate about the military role of United Germany are a direct result of the Persian Gulf War. Although Germany provided about $10 billion to support the Allied force financially, constitutional wording was interpreted as forbidding the deployment of German forces outside the North Atlantic Treaty Organization area. Well, if, in fact, this proposal goes forward, it will broaden the possibility for German military action, and if we see a resumption of the Cold War, and as I have theorized, and apparently Lanny Sintgen also has theorized, the U.S. either wants to see a new Cold War by forcing the return of a repressive Stalinist-type regime, a hardline regime, through in order to counteract the disintegration of the Soviets, or else the disintegration of the Soviet Union into a bunch of little third-world countries that would then be at the beck and call of Western multinational corporations for development. Certainly, the possibility of an expanded German military role, now a united Germany, with the loss of the cordon sanitaire in Eastern Europe that the Soviets used to have, the Warsaw Pact has now dissolved, the NATO is going strong, and as we looked at in the first installment of this series, the Soviet crackdown in the Baltics is seen as a justification for the perpetuation and revitalization of NATO. It should be understood that the Soviets will be greatly frightened by the possibility of the future confrontation, not only with the United States, but with a united Germany. That's a road they've been down before, and I think this particular development also, whether or not it was intended, certainly has to contribute to the pressure on the Soviet political and military thinkers to continue to maintain high levels of military spending. It should be noted that in yesterday's papers, although I'm not going to read it into the record, virtually all of the major newspapers yesterday being March 16th of 1991, discussed the fact that the Soviets and the Americans have reached an impasse on arms negotiations. Apparently the concurrence that has characterized recent Soviet-American relations is now coming to a halt. The Soviets don't want any more arms reductions, at least not of the type the United States is proposing. It should also be recalled that in the Sean Gervasi article that we looked at last week, one of the stratagems of the full-court press was to use arms negotiations to keep the Soviets from matching the U.S. military buildup. And obviously, the fact that they have been limited in some ways through arms negotiations has to again scare the living expletive deleted out of Soviet military thinkers. They now no longer have the Pershing missiles facing them in Europe, but they no longer have their own considerably powerful intermediate-range nuclear missiles either. I suspect that at least part of the new Soviet reluctance to limit arms may very well be due to the fact that they strategy what I perceive as the continued full-court press strategy is in fact bearing fruit. Whether or not it was intended, the Gulf War also now is spurring perhaps a wider German military role, and that also, it seems to me, will fit very nicely in, whether or not it was intended, fits very nicely into the full-court press scenario developed by Gervasi that I feel the Middle East War, among other things, is helping to further. Can't say that for sure, but once again, FFT, GFFR, food for thought and grounds for further research. I noted here that this fellow Eckhart Ehrenberg says, although the proposals have been put forward before, it's new. Well, let me tell you, it is not new. It may be something we haven't seen in a while, but expanded German militarism is not new. As William Faulkner, the novelist, said, the past is never dead and buried. It isn't even past. We're now going to proceed with one of the most important articles in the current issue of Covert Action Information Bulletin. And once again, this is Covert Action Information Bulletin's issue number 35 from the fall of 1990. And I will give the address once again for Covert Action Information Bulletin. Covert Action Information Bulletin, P.O. Box 34583, Box 34583, that's in Washington, D.C., zip code 20043. This is an absolutely essential issue, and there's a very, very important article, most of which I'm going to read into the record this evening, the rest of which I will read into the record in a future installment, probably next week. This is an article by journalists Russ Belant, last name B-E-L-L-A-N-T, and Lewis Wolf, who is one of the co-editors of Covert Action Information Bulletin, incidentally. And this is an excerpt from Belant's publication, The Coors Connection, How Coors Family Philanthropy Undermines Democratic Pluralism, which came out in 1990, published by Political Research Associates, 678 Massachusetts Avenue, Suite 205, Cambridge, Mass., 02139. Now, this article is called The Free Congress Foundation Goes East. Once again, co-authored by Russ Ballant and Lewis Wolfe. It reads in part as follows. With the rapid pace of political change sweeping Eastern Europe and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, many opportunities have emerged for Western interests to intervene in the politics of that region. In some cases, such a vacuum has been created that virtual strangers to the area several years ago are now able to actively participate in changing those societies from within. These interventions are not only being practiced by mainstream organizations. The involvement of the United States far right brings with it the potential revival of fascist organizations in the East. One U.S. group, the Free Congress Foundation, has been playing a role in Eastern European and Soviet politics and has ties to Boris Yeltsin and the Interregional Deputies Group, or IRG, in the USSR. Now, once again, this is the most important single element in this article on the subject of it, the Free Congress Foundation, and we should bear in mind for future discussion that they are tied directly to Boris Yeltsin, as we shall see. Continuing here with Ballant and Wolfe's article, the Free Congress Foundation, or FCF, was founded in 1974 by Paul Weyrich, W-E-Y-R-I-C-H, as the Committee for the Survival of a Free Congress. Weyrich, who had started the Heritage Foundation the year before, was heavily funded by the Coors family for both organizations. I would interrupt that Paul Weyrich is one of the major strategic planners and one of the major figures in the so-called New Right. Why I call it so-called, I will outline here later. He is one of the individuals credited with the political action committees and direct mail techniques which helped boost Ronald Reagan and later George Bush into their present situations, although as I've looked at in these archive shows, the stage was set for the Reagan and Bush ascendancy by political assassination, not Paul Weyrich. Continuing here, but it should be noted that in addition to the survival, the Committee for the Survival of a Free Congress, now the Free Congress Foundation, Weyrich founded the Heritage Foundation, an absolutely pivotal right-wing think tank, which, again, is very close to both the Reagan and Bush administrations. Continuing here, and bear in mind that this organization, as we shall see, is heavily involved in the Soviet Union, specifically with elements around Boris Yeltsin. Continuing with the article, Weyrich has kept one foot in the right wing of the Republican Party while dallying with the racist right and the extreme Christian right. In 1976, for instance, he and a handful of other new rightists, William Rusher, Morton Blackwell, and Richard Viguerie, attempted to take over the Segregationist American Independent Party, or AIP, formed by George Wallace in 1968. The AIP was an amalgam of Ku Klux Klan and John Birch Society elements. In 1982, Weyrich published an essay in which he stated, quote, "Culturally destructive government policies, racial hiring quotas, and busing come to mind as examples, are to the new right more immediately important in the realm of action since the damage they can do is enormous and practically irremediable," unquote. This apparent defense of, quote, white culture, unquote, is dangerously close to theories advocated by white supremacists today. FCF's direct involvement in Eastern Europe began about a year ago at the urging of one of its directors, Robert Kriebel, K-R-I-E-B-L-E, a retired Connecticut businessman. His Kriebel Foundation backed efforts in late 1989 to send Weyrich and four associates to Hungary and the Soviet Union, including Estonia, to help train right-wing leaders in ideological and electoral matters. I would interject here, Estonia is now one of the Baltic republics pushing for independence. Weyrich stated upon his return that his visit to Moscow was, quote, "the most incredible experience of our lives," unquote. There, he worked with the IRG of the Supreme Soviet, a leadership body of the Communist Party. He says that they were unequivocally in favor of private property, a market economy, and the restoration of religion. The IRG was established by Andrei Sakharov, Boris Yeltsin, and others in the summer of 1989. By the end of that year, a training school had been established for candidates to put forward the IRG program. Their electoral success this year propelled Yeltsin to the leadership of the Russian Soviet Socialist Republic. He immediately began forging collaborative relationships with the deeply reactionary leaders of the Lithuanian Sąjūdis Party. The IRG has also served as a source of right-wing pressure on Gorbachev to dismantle socialism and the Soviet Union itself. Now recall, in the very first installment of this archive series, I analyzed another very important article. I read into the record another very important article dealing with Sąjūdis and the restoration of fascism in Lithuania, because Sąjūdis is inextricably linked with the history of Lithuanian fascism. And it's interesting to see Boris Yeltsin now hooking up with Sąjūdis, an ironic name. Perhaps instead of S-A-J-U-D-I-S, it should be spelled S-A capital J-U-D-A-S, because it looks like that's basically where they're at, Sąjūdis. And it should be noted here, as before we proceed into this particular article, that in the Sean Gervasi article that I read into the record last week, the destabilization paradigm involves two basic elements. The first is external pressure, and I have spoken about that in the first two installments. The second is internal manipulation, and I'm going to reread a short section of the Sean Gervasi article. Again, this is called The Full Court Press, The Destabilization of the Soviet Union by Sean Gervasi. And a section of it reads, "The typical campaign of destabilization has involved two elements. The first is external pressure. The second is internal manipulation. The attacker is bent on creating disruption and turmoil in the target country, but that is only its first objective. The ultimate purpose is to produce political change, typically a change of government, a coup d'etat, or even a revolution. There can be no assurance, however, that disruption and turmoil will produce the desired political results. Therefore, in most cases, the attacking power also intervenes in the internal political process in the target country." And that brings us again to the article which I'm going to resume with, The Free Congress Foundation Goes East. We've looked at external pressure, including, in my opinion, the resuscitation of Star Wars and perhaps the resuscitation of wider German military involvement. And we are now going to proceed with the Free Congress Foundation and its activities with IRG and Boris Yeltsin. And this is one of the vehicles that appears to be being used for internal political manipulation in the Soviet Union, the second of the two pincers described in the Sean Gervasi destabilization paradigm. Continuing with this article, "One of the key dangers in this agenda is the political vacuum it creates, allowing ultra-nationalist forces in a number of republics to increase their influence and possibly take power." Now, by the way, I should read the last couple of sentences again. "The IRG has also served as a source of right-wing pressure on Gorbachev to dismantle socialism and the Soviet Union itself. One of the key dangers in this agenda is the political vacuum it creates, allowing ultra-nationalist forces in a number of republics to increase their influence and possibly take power. Such nationalist and fascist elements are already evident in Lithuania and the Ukraine. In the latter republic, the pro-Nazi Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, or OUN, has gained influence in several parties and has mobilized large demonstrations that honor OUN leaders who abetted Hitler's war on the Eastern Front. Similarly, several Sąjūdis deputies served in German-supported military units in 1944, and Sąjūdis has made declarations against ethnic Russians living in Lithuania. According to some reports, Poles have also been denigrated. It should also be noted that radical reformer, quote-unquote, Boris Yeltsin has dallied with Pamyat, P-A-M-Y-A-T, the foremost Russian fascist group to emerge in the last several years. Pamyat's virulent anti-Semitism compares to the crude propaganda of the early German Nazi Party in the 1920s. Interrupting, we will take a look at Pamyat later on in this installment. Continuing, "The FCF is not entirely disconnected from the history of the OUN. The treasurer of the FCF board is George Washington University professor Charles Moser, M-O-S-E-R. Moser also serves on the editorial advisory board of the Ukrainian Quarterly, published by the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America, a group dominated by the OUN. The Ukrainian Quarterly has praised military units of the German SS and otherwise justified the OUN alliance with the Third Reich, which reflects the fact that the OUN was politically and militarily allied with Hitler and the Nazi occupation of the Ukraine. The OUN, an international semi-secret cadre organization headquartered in Bavaria, has received financial assistance from the late Franz Josef Strauss, the rightist head of the Bavarian state. Strauss also had a working relationship with Weyrich. Weyrich fed speeches by Strauss attacking Germany's détente with the USSR to U.S. senators who would then insert them into the congressional record. When Strauss came to Washington, Weyrich was the person who helped set up his itinerary. Another indicator of the anti-democratic character of the FCF's foreign policy is its co-sponsorship of Freedom Fighter newsletter. Freedom Fighter, edited by Charles Moser, is published from FCF offices in conjunction with Jack Wheeler's Freedom Research Foundation. It reports on and supports the military operations of RENAMO, R-E-N-A-M-O, in Mozambique, UNITA in Angola, the Nicaraguan Contras, and similar groups in Southeast Asia, Northern Africa, and Afghanistan. Particularly telling is their support of the South African-sponsored RENAMO operation, which even the State Department has denounced for its scorched-earth terror and murder of more than 100,000 Mozambicans. Pausing at this point, we should look here again at the affiliation between Charles Moser, described as the treasurer of the FCF board, and the elements grouped around the OUN. In Radio Free America number 1 and Radio Free America shows 14 and 15, we took a look at the OUN, its work with the Third Reich, its work with the Galen Organization, and its work with not only the Central Intelligence Agency when the Galen Group became part of the CIA, but also we took a look at it as a major element in the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, or ABN. We're going to take a look at ABN later on in this particular article. The anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations is an organization, as we shall see, which goes back to 1943, literally a link with the Third Reich, and it is one of the major elements in the World Anti-Communist League, a major vehicle of both a major fount of foreign policy inspiration and a major vehicle for covert action in the Reagan and Bush administrations. We also took a look at OUN-UPA and the ABN in a miscellaneous archive show entitled Nazis and Anti-Semites on the George Bush Campaign that was aired in November of 1988. That also, by the way, based in considerable measure on work done by Russ Ballant, the co-author of this article. And again, the involvement of OUN-UPA, which incidentally is also an organization along with the ABN, which has links going to the assassination of President Kennedy, as we looked at in Radio Free America 15. This is an organization directly connected, or linked, I should say, to Charles Moser, and Moser involved, as we see here, very much with FCF. Continuing with this article. Despite his long associations with anti-democratic elements, Weyrich has been able to get money from the National Endowment for Democracy, or NED, the congressionally funded agency designed to intervene openly in the politics of other countries. Most recently, he was granted $40,000 to pass along to the Initiatives Foundation in Moscow, which is a non-profit affiliate of the IRG. The money is intended to assist in the purchase of communications hardware, including facsimile machines, duplicators, computers, desktop publishers, video cameras, and VCRs and supplies. In a recent fundraising appeal sent to select potential donors, Weyrich claimed that in every election except Romania, every group they trained won the elections. In a videotape accompanying the letter, he says that FCF trained Boris Yeltsin's campaign manager. Those last two sentences again. In a recent fundraising appeal sent to select potential donors, Weyrich claimed that in every election except Romania, every group they trained won the elections. In a videotape accompanying the letter, he says that FCF trained Boris Yeltsin's campaign manager. Continuing. Paul Weyrich has voiced skepticism about the intent of Ronald Reagan's White House heir to perpetuate the ultra-conservative agenda. Quote, whether George Bush will rise to the occasion is another question, unquote. I would interject that he apparently has. Continuing, with this distrust of his party's leaders and the government's program in Eastern Europe, Weyrich decided in 1989 to join forces with his closest allies in establishing FCF's newest center, quote unquote, the Center for Freedom and Democracy. This center will work full-time on Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union to train, quote, train opposition leaders in the principles and mechanics of democracy, unquote. Well, as we've seen, just like the inappropriately named National Endowment for Democracy, this particular organization, the Center for Freedom and Democracy, would appear to be concerned with anything but freedom and democracy. Links to people like and institutions like the OUN and Sejudis would indicate that. And I think really here, when they talk about freedom, they're talking about getting people to work for free. Continuing here. Another objective of the center's programs is, quote, teaching free market principles. The foundation is helping to create economic opportunities for American companies, unquote. The budget of the center is approximately $450,000. Now, there's a list here of various operations that the Free Congress Foundation has engaged in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. I'm simply going to read the ones dealing with the Soviet Union this evening. We will come to others dealing with other Eastern European nations formerly in the Soviet bloc in a forthcoming broadcast, probably next week or maybe the week after that. Among the FCF-conducted training programs, Ballant and Wolf list, Moscow, Soviet Union, November of 1989. Over 4.5 days in training sessions co-sponsored by FCF and the Academy of National Economy under the Soviet Council of Ministers, some 80 Soviets, one-fourth of whom were members of the Supreme Soviet or the House of Deputies and members of the key opposition force, IRG, were given intensive indoctrination in, quote, levels of political thinking, development of tactics, strategy, goals, and decision-making in a campaign, unquote. The participants were trained in, quote, the political techniques of recruitment of volunteers, organization of volunteers, identification and turnout of volunteers, election day activities, the building of coalitions, and methods of communicating with the voters, unquote. FCF says unabashedly, again quoting, we trained the Yeltsin group in its effort to win control of the Russian Republic. That last sentence again, FCF says unabashedly, quote, we trained the Yeltsin group in its effort to win control of the Russian Republic, unquote. We're going to come back to this particular section of the article later on. Another of the FCF training programs listed here by Ballant and Wolf, Tallinn, Estonia, November of 1989. Tallinn is T-A-L-L-I-N-N. Over a four-day period, FCF trainers met with some 70 members of opposition groups whose main agenda is independence from the USSR. FCF set forth information on, quote, political strategy and organizational politics, unquote. The Estonian Heritage Society, the Estonian National Independence Party, the Popular Front in Tallinn, and the Estonia Citizens Committee provided the trainees. And skipping down, then there are others, as I said, listed here in various other areas of Eastern Europe. Moscow, Leningrad, and Sverdlovsk, Soviet Union, April 1990. Sverdlovsk, by the way, is S-V-E-R-D-L-O-V-S-K. Building on the close working relations that had developed between the Free Congress Foundation and the interregional group, some 60 people in Moscow were divided into small groups and taught through role-playing exercises. These exercises focused on governing at the executive, legislative, and judicial levels of local, regional, and national government. In Sverdlovsk, 235 persons performed similar role-playing exercises. In Leningrad, 45 people attended the FCF personnel, in Leningrad, 45 people attended with the FCF personnel playing the role of the judiciary. In these meetings, participants were lectured about, quote, how free enterprise operates, unquote. And skipping down, those are the FCF training sessions. Most recently, a delegation of 6 senior Soviet political and economic opposition figures and officials met in Washington, D.C., with senior-level U.S. officials at a conference entitled, quote, the coming Russian-American alliance in the post-communist era, unquote. The October 2nd through 4th conference, co-sponsored by FCF and Independence University, were closed to the media. The delegates were treated to a one-hour meeting with Vice President Dan Quayle. The Soviet participants included Arkady Murashev, who has been schooled by FCF in Moscow. Murashev is M-U-R-A-S-H-E-V, Arkady, A-R-K-A-D-Y. Continuing, Murashev is the executive secretary of Yeltsin's IRG. Also in attendance were Yeltsin's chief of staff, Gennady Burbulis, G-E-N-N-A-D-I-B-U-R-B-U-L-I-S, National Security Commission chair and former Soviet Navy Lieutenant Commander Vladimir Lopatin, V-L-A-D-I-M-I-R-L-O-P-A-T-I-N, Minister of Publishing and Information Mikhail Poltoranin, P-O-L-T-O-R-A-N-I-N, People's Deputy and Head of the Siberia Legislative District, Stanislav Selenev, S-E-L-E-Z-N-E-V, and Commission on Economic Reform Chairman S. Sulakshin, S-U-L-A-K-S-H-I-N. These are the people who were in attendance at this conference in Washington, D.C., along with Arkady Murashev, the executive secretary of Yeltsin's IRG, very closely allied with and trained by, obviously, the Free Congress Foundation of Paul Ryrick, Charles Moser, etc. Continuing. Boris Yeltsin, recently injured in an automobile accident, sent a letter to the combined delegates stressing his political program. Quote, "We seek to create an economic system based upon universal market mechanisms and the sacred right of every person to property. The entrepreneur will become the chief actor in our economy," unquote. Those in attendance from the U.S. included Housing and Urban Development Secretary Jack Kemp, Assistant Secretary of State John Bolton, B-O-L-T-O-N, Deputy Energy Secretary Henson Moore, Assistant Commerce Secretary for International Economic Policy Tom Duesterberg, D-U-E-S-T-E-R-B-E-R-G, former Assistant Secretary at the Pentagon Richard Perle, former Assistant Attorney General William Bradford Reynolds, Burton Yale Pines of the Heritage Foundation, former Governor of Delaware Pierre Pete DuPont, and two longtime Cold War advocates from local academia, Charles Moser and Peter Redaway, R-E-D-D-A-W-A-Y. Notably, CAIB has learned that Free Congress Foundation coordinated the arrangements for the Soviets' visas directly with Dan Quayle's office rather than through the State Department. Recall, once again, that Charles Moser is the fellow linked with the Ukrainian Quarterly and connected with elements grouped around the OUN. Continuing with the article. Arkady Murashev has visited FCF's Washington office three times during visits to the U.S. Further, Weirich has noted that leaders of the newly formed Russian Christian Democratic Party came to FCF offices in July. They told the FCF their party platform and their belief that, quote, only a religious and moral rebirth will open the pathways to beneficial transformations, unquote. President Zhelev Zelev of Bulgaria was also received at FCF in September. That man's name is Zhelyv and Zhelev. Continuing. Those seeking guidance from the FCF for a, quote, religious and moral rebirth, unquote, would be well advised to consider the company that FCF keeps. The Free Congress Foundation is generally identified with the secular New Right rather than the religious New Right, but in fact, it melds both currents of rightist activity. Although structurally one organization, FCF could be seen as a dozen semi-independent groups housed in one office complex and with one boss. The FCF divides many of its activities into centers, quote-unquote. There are centers for government and politics, law and democracy, cultural conservatism, state policy, conservative governance, child and family policy, foreign policy, transportation policy, Catholic policy, and the new freedom and democracy. In the FCF's 1988 annual report, the Center for Catholic Policy states, quote, "The public policy influence and activity of the Catholic Church in America often runs counter to the interests of Catholic laity. The Center for Catholic Policy seeks to instruct conservative Catholic laity how to become influential in shaping public policy stands taken by the Church," unquote. The FCF report says that a, quote, "network of some 40 national Catholic organizations, institutions, and publications which share a generally conservative viewpoint," unquote, was formed by FCF in January 1988 and called the Siena Group, capital S-I-E-N-A. According to the FCF, again quoting, "Among the top priorities of the Siena Group in 1988 was mobilizing opposition to a U.S. Catholic Conference statement on AIDS policy which was favorable to the objectives of the gay and lesbian rights movement. Siena Group participants convinced the bishops to set aside the AIDS document." This last section of the article is a very important one. Well, the whole article is very important, and I'm going to analyze it in just a couple of minutes. The person that we're going to be focusing on here is an individual we spoke about in the aforementioned miscellaneous archive show, Nazis and Anti-Semites on the George Bush Campaign, that aired in September of 1988. This individual is named Laszlo Pastor, L-A-S-Z-L-O-P-A-S-Z-T-O-R, and he is an individual who stems from fascist Hungary. It should be recalled that in addition to Germany, Italy, and Japan, the Axis also involved Bulgaria, Romania, and Hungary. All of those countries were fascist and fought alongside the Third Reich against the Soviet Union and also the United States. Laszlo Pastor goes back. He was a Hungarian fascist. He also was heavily involved with the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, that key and most reactionary element of WACL that I spoke about earlier. Speaking about his connection here to Free Congress Foundation, the inappropriately named Free Congress Foundation. Finally, FCF's, now continuing here with Bland and Wolf's article, finally, FCF's insinuation into the politics of the East must be judged by their selection of Laszlo Pastor to head their Liberation Support Alliance, quote, which seeks to liberate peoples in Central and Eastern European nations, unquote. Pastor's involvement in East European politics began in World War II when he joined the youth organization of the Arrow Cross, the Nazi Party of Hungary. When the Arrow Cross was installed in power by a German commando operation, Pastor was sent to Berlin to help facilitate the liaison between the Arrow Cross and Hitler. Pastor was tried and served 2 years in jail for his Arrow Cross activities after an anti-communist government was elected in Hungary in 1945. He eventually came to the U.S. and established the ethnic arm of the Republican National Committee for Richard Nixon. He brought other Nazi collaborators from the Eastern Front into the GOP. Some were later found to have participated in mass murder during the war. I would interrupt. That is the organization, the Republican Ethnic Heritage Council, that we spoke about in the aforementioned miscellaneous archive show, Nazis and Anti-Semites in the George Bush Campaign. Continuing here with Bland and Wolf's article. The dormant Arrow Cross has surfaced again in Hungary, where there have been attempts to lift the ban on the Nazi organization. Pastor spent several months in Hungary. When Paul Weyrich later conducted training there, he was provided a list of Pastor's contacts inside the country. Weyrich reports that he conducted training for the recently formed and now governing party, New Democratic Forum. Pastor claims to have assisted some of his friends in Hungary in getting NED funds through his advisory position with NED. Recall that NED is the organization which, through LCRA, Lithuanian Catholic Religious Aid, and the closely allied Lithuanian Information Center, is re-injecting fascist elements into Lithuania under Sejudis. We looked at that in the first installment of this archive series. Continuing with the article, Pastor seems to have assisted some of his friends in Hungary in getting NED funding through his advisory position with NED. In 1989, he spoke at the Heritage Foundation under the sponsorship of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, or ABN, a multinational umbrella organization of emigre fascists and Nazis founded in alliance with Hitler in 1943. It is led by the OUN. Pastor spoke for the, quote, Hungarian organization, unquote, of ABN, which is the Arrow Cross. And now, Bland's conclusion here. Those leaders and cadre trained over the last year by Free Congress Foundation's traveling tutors were led by Paul Weyrich and company to believe in themselves and the goals set before them. However, they aren't on Weyrich's mailing list of key opinion shapers, so they aren't aware of his real assessment of them. Quote, but of course, communists will behave as communists, and they are going to try to undercut democratic forces whenever they can. Democratic leaders such as Havel, Zhelev, or Landsbergis are not entirely prepared to cope with such situations. In fact, former communists such as Boris Yeltsin appear to be more capable of producing real change than those Eastern European leaders are, mainly because as communists, they learned how to use power. There are only a few non-communists like Arkady Murashev who know how to do things right, unquote. FCF's involvement in Eastern Europe has begun as a result of their expertise in electing U.S. conservatives to office. This campaign expertise has enhanced their reputation in national politics. But their ties, which suggest an ultimately anti-democratic agenda, including their emigre fascist and Christian fascist involvement, have gone unexamined. Free Congress Foundation's advocacy of a narrow range of social conformity and literal repression of nonconformists in the U.S. can be found in their detailed literature on the subject. It is reasonable to expect that those in the East seeking aid for the new arena of electoral activity may not know FCF's deeper agenda. It is up to Americans to communicate that warning and to challenge NED tax dollars to FCF that certainly legitimize it in the eyes of some political groups in the East. And That is something of an understatement. I don't know how effectively people could communicate with people in the East, but we will now take a musical break, and then I'm going to come back. We will continue with tonight's archive show, and specifically I'm going to recap and analyze the major points of this very important and very well-written article by Russ Ballant and Lewis Wolf. As I said, we are now looking at some of the vehicles for the internal intervention in the Soviet Union, and my guess is that ultimately the Soviet hardliners and their military will crack down rather than see people like this fragment the Soviet Union. Now, it remains to be seen, but they have already stated that they will not stand for the breakup of the USSR. We shall see what happens. A musical break and then a continuation of tonight's archive show.